Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
We have an ongoing occupation in Iraq where most soldiers that continue to serve there have completely dehumanized the Iraqi people. And so these things are still ongoing.
We're pleased to interview award-winning journalist Dar Jamail, who returned from Iraq 2 weeks ago and has been writing about the January elections, ongoing violence, the loss of Iraqi culture, increasing poverty, environmental damage, a lack of electricity, and a lack of access to health care. Dar Jamail is author of the 2008 book Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Here's Dar in February 2004, speaking to WHUS Radio from Iraq.
Where is the $20 billion that he spent on reconstruction? There's no reconstruction. People are dying of cholera just like they did during the sanctions. If someone had showed up in Iraq just a couple of years ago and started asking people whether they're Sunni or Shia, that's actually considered very rude.
He spent 8 months in Iraq covering the war on the ground during 2003 and 2004 as one of only a handful of journalists traveling without the U.S. military. Eventually, he saw a large increase in the number of U.S. soldiers willing to say no to the war and in soldiers willing to talk about the horrors they had seen or participated in Iraq. It was a story that evolved into the Winter Soldier Tour, which Dar also covered. His forthcoming book is Military Resistors, Soldiers Who Refused to Fight in Iraq, another Haymarket book. It's due out later this year. Dar Jamail, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, Dori. Good to be with you.
Dar, it's been about 6 years now since the Bush administration took us to war in Iraq. What's the status of any reconstruction of, let's say, civilian homes or other types of essential structures at this point?
You know, Dori, this was the thing that when I first went into Iraq this trip, which was my first trip back there in almost 4 years, I expected to see at least some evidence of some kind of reconstruction. And I was really taken aback by the fact that not only had there been almost no reconstruction that was visible whatsoever, that in fact, overall, the situation had grown significantly worse. Going around Baghdad, seeing all the same buildings that had been bombed during the invasion were in the same exact state as the last time I was there 4 years ago. They still were lying in total ruin. And then when we look at things like critical infrastructure, like the amount of electricity availability, water, jobs available, et cetera, everything was worse on every measurable level. So throughout the capital city, the average house had about 2 hours of electricity per 24 hours, which meant maybe you'd get 15 minutes here, maybe you'd get 2 hours the next day, maybe you'd come in the middle of the night. The point is, it's basically worthless. You can't really live or run a refrigerator or keep your house cool or warm or anything with sporadic electricity like that. Compounding that, according to the World Health Organization, 45% of Iraqis don't even have access to safe drinking water. So you would think, well, maybe I can go buy a generator, maybe I can go buy some bottled water. But then the problem is that unemployment is ranging between 50 and 70%, which is absolutely staggering. I mean, that's just about twice the level of unemployment that we saw in this country during the Great Depression. So on all these levels, not even talking about an ongoing security situation that, while it's better than it was, say, compared to a year ago, we're still looking at just about a car bomb a day someplace in Baghdad. I mean, when I was there for a month this trip, and almost every day there was a car bomb somewhere in Baghdad. Almost every day the Green Zone was being mortared. I could hear it because I was in a hotel about five blocks from there. Almost every day there were clashes breaking out somewhere in Baghdad. Definitely every day there were kidnappings. So that is the overall security situation. So sure, it's safe to say that compared to the bloodletting in Iraq a year and a half ago where on average between 100 and 300 Iraqis were being killed every single day, instead we're looking at between maybe 10 and 50 Iraqis being killed a day. So it's easy for pundits to sit over here in the United States and say, well, that's better. Well, I would challenge them to take their families and go live in Baghdad.
You showed pictures on your website and in some of these stories of what looked to be very substantial dividing walls. Can you give us a sense of how many of these walls have been constructed and where they are?
Yes, the capital city of Baghdad is really a city of walls now. This was part of the so-called troop surge program where the U.S. went in. It was a second phase of a program where they started during the U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte when he was in charge of basically setting up and running the sectarian death squads in Iraq, which was the same thing he did down in Honduras and in Central America during the Reagan administration, where basically sectarian-based death squads went out and were used to essentially segregate neighborhoods. So most of the neighborhoods, for example, in Baghdad before the invasion were mixed, Sunni and Shia living together. I talked to so many Iraqis that, like people here maybe in the United States, they had no idea whether the neighbor was Sunni or Shia, just like here. You don't know, you know, you don't like walk up to someone and ask what their particular brand of Christianity is. It'd just be kind of an odd thing to do. Well, it's the same thing there. But that all changed with the occupation when the U.S. came in and basically started trying to classify Iraqis and segregate them. And so all of these mixed neighborhoods became either Sunni or Shia. And then the next stage of this program, as part of the surge program, was to essentially wall off these neighborhoods and control access. So you go around Baghdad and you see entire neighborhoods, 300,000-400,000 people, that are completely encircled in giant 12-foot-high blast walls with choke points controlled by American or Iraqi forces. At this point, it's more Iraqi forces. It's really an amazing thing to see. And, of course, the people living in these neighborhoods are not happy about it because, I mean, you can just use your imagination to think, well, what would it be like to live in a neighborhood where if I'm going to go anywhere outside that neighborhood, I'm going to have to go wait in a very long line and go through a checkpoint and be searched and have my car searched, maybe be harassed, maybe have bribes extracted from me by the corrupt security people that are actually militiamen. You can understand that this is not a very fun way to live, but that is how most people in Baghdad today are having to live.
Well, to say nothing of reporters who might be discouraged from heading out into Iraq itself to talk to people as you always do. Now, what about the way the U.S. Embassy must appear? It almost looks like that shining city on the hill, Disneyland kind of effect as compared to what the rest of Iraq looks like today.
It really is. It's a stark contrast. And I have some photos of this on my website, and I would encourage people to have a look at what their tax dollars are doing. Calling it an embassy is a bit of a joke. I always try to remember to put the word embassy in quotes because this is a compound the size of the Vatican City. It has room for over 1,000 so-called government employees. It has its own security force. And when you look at it, it's absolutely massive and sprawling, and it's right on the banks of the Tigris River inside the Green Zone. So I talked about the situation of the average Iraqi earlier of no water, no electricity, no jobs, patrols running around in their streets. There's basically not much security to speak of whatsoever. And then they look across the Tigris River and see this sprawling so-called embassy that's been built at a tune of $1 billion, built on slave labor, imported workers from impoverished countries like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. And Iraqis see that, and you can imagine the amount of resentment that generates.
You also showed pictures of an Iraqi fisherman demonstrating how shallow the Tigris River is right now. Is that a consequence of the occupation?
The key issue with the Tigris River today is pollution that is a direct result of the occupation. Definitely there's far less water in the Tigris. In fact, this fisherman estimated that it was about half the levels that it used to be. But we can't blame the occupation for this. We can blame upstream dams in places like Turkey or in Syria. This is a problem of overall water shortage that if we're going to really talk about this, we probably have to have a longer discussion about climate change, where the entire Middle East is in a growing crisis of lack of water. And the fact that the Tigris River now, which is a very, very huge river, is flowing in Iraq at about half the levels that it used to flow at is, I think, indicative of the fact that countries in the Middle East are getting more desperate on where are we going to find fresh water sources. But as a kind of indirect result of this, the occupation of Iraq and total lack of regulation of what's allowed to be dumped into the Tigris, what's controlling it, what's keeping it from being polluted. Even under the regime of the dictator Saddam Hussein, people who were caught polluting the river, dumping garbage in it or sewage, were punished severely. But just like the borders of Iraq being opened wide up by the occupation and having no control, the Tigris River, there's basically been no control over who's dumping what in it. And I actually, in previous trips, I interviewed a contractor once who was working in the green zone around the construction site of the so-called embassy, who quit in protest because so much waste, things like oil and gas and garbage by occupation forces and contractors in the green zone, was being literally just dumped straight into the Tigris River. And I can personally attest to this. I've gone out on the river now twice on two separate boat trips, one back in summer 2004 and one just about a month ago. And there are parts of the river that are so polluted, you literally have to hold your nose going down them. I mean, there's raw sewage being dumped into it. You can see plastic garbage bags floating under the surface. There's piles of garbage on other areas of the banks. I mean, it's horribly, horribly polluted. And the fact is that this is really one of the main drinking sources for the entire capital city. And I'm in a privileged position where I can afford to buy and live off of bottled water when I'm in there. But most Iraqis can't do that. And that's why we have things like, even up at the end of last summer, we had cholera outbreaks around the capital city, where we had literally dozens and dozens of people die in Baghdad from cholera, and then other waterborne diseases that are rampant in the capital city. And that's how severe the situation is.
And reading your February and March stories for Interpress Service, you wrote about Iraq's doctors and the hospitals. And I've gotten the impression that Iraq is increasingly now divided by wealth and status, because on the one hand, there seem to be some Iraqi doctors working in hiding who treat patients as they can, the hospitals now providing more complicated procedures right away for those who can afford to pay. How do you think that, first, the Iraq war has contributed to all of this, the occupation, but also, what is America's responsibility here? We still occupy this country.
It's really amazing. It's another really aspect of the total lack of support for the Iraqi people and the total lack of reconstruction. I mean, early on in the occupation, anyone who had followed the situation of Iraq knew how devastating the sanctions were to the medical infrastructure. I mean, you had entire hospital complexes in Iraq, huge medical complexes, that during the sanctions literally didn't have an aspirin to give to someone who was in pain. That's how devastated they were by the sanctions. And starting out, there was at least $1 billion earmarked to go into the medical infrastructure reconstruction. And here we are coming up on the six-year anniversary of the occupation, and the government health system, which is what the vast majority of Iraqis have to rely on because most of those services are free, which used to be kind of the pride of Iraq. I mean, it was the best medical system in the Middle East, has been completely devastated, and there's been nothing done to help reconstruct it. And so as a result, today, we have private hospitals for Iraqis who can afford it, which are a very distinct minority. That's where doctors can go and be paid more money. They have better facilities to work with. They actually have the equipment they need to do their job. And then those fortunate enough to be able to pay for it can go there and get good service. But as a result, this is actually causing even more problems to the public health system, which is, I would roughly estimate, probably 85% of Iraqis. It's their only option to go that route because they don't have money. And so more of the doctors working in the public sector are going over to the private sector. So literally this rise of a privatization of sort of a small case privatization of the health sector is actually sucking away doctors and supplies and money from the government system, which is in dire need of some kind of support. So again, it is a situation where, as you say, the wealthy and those privileged enough to be able to afford those services can do okay, at least for the moment, and get what they need. But it really is at the expense of the vast majority of Iraqis. And all of this is a direct result of the total failure and the total negligence of the U.S. occupation authorities in a following through with the promises they made early on in the occupation. Some of this we talked about, Doria. I remember way back in December 2003, it was an absolutely devastating situation then, and it's become worse today. And again, this is not a big surprise when you follow the situation in Iraq. Anyone who's followed it closely at all understands how much corruption has taken place. Just in the first year of the occupation alone under the CPA, to this date, $7 billion is quote-unquote missing. There's been zero accountability, total corruption, and of course, at the end of the day, this results in people like the average Iraqi is left with no infrastructure and really no recourse at this point.
I remember speaking with you in 2003 about hospitals that were bombed, And people were surprised to hear that U.S. forces were, in fact, bombing hospitals. But also, you know, fast forward now to 2007, 2008, the U.S. military continued to bomb around the areas where there were clinics and doctors were fleeing even then, right?
It's true. I mean, this has been really standard operating procedure for the military. Anytime there's a large-scale operation that they're involved in, the targeting of the medical infrastructure is always part of the program. And, you know, it's really something that, when, for example, when you look at what the Israeli military does in Gaza or other parts around Palestine, and what the U.S. military does, in not just in Iraq, but in other areas where it operates around the globe, it's funny to me that it always seems like people are shocked to hear, as though, oh, the U.S. military, they only attack quote-unquote legitimate targets, and they're always shocked to hear of things like attacking medical infrastructure or killing civilians and other war crimes like this. Even when it's possible now to hear testimony directly from soldiers themselves that have done these things, like at the Winter Soldier event, for example, and ongoing Winter Soldier events around the United States, people are still surprised to hear this. But what's interesting to me is that I think most people in this country don't really understand what war looks like. And that is what happens in war. The inevitable consequence are that war crimes occur, whether it's the bombing of the medical infrastructure or the deliberate targeting of civilians and the dehumanization that precedes all of this. That's what happens. And so the fact that we have an ongoing occupation in Iraq, where most soldiers that continue to serve there have completely dehumanized the Iraqi people. And so these things are still ongoing. And in fact, one situation, literally the day before I left Baghdad, a colleague that I was working with, a cameraman named Jason Coppola, actually went into Sadr City and filmed a demonstration that took place because the day before there had been a home raid by American soldiers and someone in the home had been executed. All the gold and money in the home had been looted by soldiers. So this is ongoing. This is what occupation and war look like. So that kind of behavior, coupled with the ongoing targeting of medical infrastructure, of ambulances, of hospitals, anytime there's a large military operation, this is just what war looks like.
We've had a tour that has come to Connecticut recently, General David Petraeus. He's more or less become the darling of the Republican right, you know, specifically Representative John Boehner sort of promotes him and features himself in a photograph next to Petraeus on websites and so on. And Petraeus appears to be touring America in an effort to convince people that he is now the quote-unquote honest military leader, ready to inform us about what U.S. policy ought to be like in Iraq and Afghanistan, too. And in fact, one local network introduced a segment about the Connecticut appearance by claiming that Petraeus was brutally honest during this event, where he was, you know, it was kind of a town hall meeting. Seemed very politicized to me. What truths do you imagine that these audiences, a lot of young people, need to hear the most about people like Petraeus and others who have been long, you know, perpetrating this war, if you will, in Iraq and now heading for Afghanistan?
Well, people need to get the facts about General David Petraeus. This is a guy who has perfected falling forward into an art form. We've heard the saying that people are basically promoted to their level of incompetence. That is a classic situation with this guy. Just look at his history in Iraq, for example. This is a guy who was in charge of during both sieges of Fallujah, both sieges which essentially completely devastated the country, turned more Iraqis against the occupation than had been against it prior to that. And to this day, this is a city that lies in nearly complete ruin. And he was in charge of that situation. We can look at him being directly in charge of the situation in Mosul up until before he was promoted to overall commander of the situation in Iraq. And again, look at the biggest problem spot in Iraq today. It's Mosul. In fact, less than 2 weeks ago, there was another ongoing huge U.S. military operation up there because they cannot control the situation. And this was a situation that General Petraeus had taken credit for several years ago, saying, we have solved the problem. Mosul is now the model city for the rest of Iraq. He had said the same thing about Fallujah. And look at both of those situations today, and those have his fingerprints all over it. of course, from both of those situations, then he's promoted into commander of the entire situation in Iraq, and then from there, he is promoted to the leader of CENTCOM. And this is a guy who really, if we look at him and just his simple resume and his track record, I mean, he really, what has he done that's really been a success? Are you going to then look at Iraq and he's going to take credit for success in Iraq? It's absolutely ridiculous. We're looking at a situation where over 1 million people are dead. 1 out of 6 Iraqis are displaced from their home. Unemployment's between 50% and 70%. And most people who have fled the country have no intention whatsoever of returning. And he's calling this a success, and he's taking credit for this as being some kind of a warrior. It's really amazing, Dory, but at the same time, I guess it shouldn't be surprising, because this is a country that still likes to edify and celebrate people like Oliver North, people like John Negroponte, and others of that ilk, who still manage to get coveted positions in the government or become pundits on national television networks. So in that way, I guess it shouldn't be a big surprise.
Listeners, this was Dar Jamail reporting to us from Iraq in April of 2004.
I have seen firsthand the glaring disparity between what the military reports and what is really going on. And most of the mainstream media over-focuses on the military aspect and their side of the story. And I feel like people back home have no idea of how horrendous the situation is here.
Dar, you've covered the Iraq war, but you've also talked about the U.S. press quite frequently. Have there been any improvements in America's media? How important is community radio like WHUS and the other stations that Talk Nation Radio airs on?
Well, the state of America's media, it's in an all-time low. It is completely disintegrating. I mean, we see now one result of the economic crisis. Just about every day a major newspaper is going under. There's less reporters abroad. Foreign bureaus started closing them years ago. That's accelerating today. Just speaking about Iraq specifically, as of December, all 3 main U.S. national TV networks pulled out all their full-time correspondents. So there's less coverage of what's actually happening. And then, of course, the last people standing are the people the most deeply embedded in these media systems that have basically been lapdogs for the state from the beginning. And it's a critical time. I think, you know, all of that adds up to say that it's a more critical time for independent reporting than ever before. There's fewer reporters on the ground. And when we look at the situation in Iraq today, I think one really troubling thing is that so many people in this country think that, well, Barack Obama's in charge now, and so he's going to solve all these problems. And the reality is, coupled with almost total lack of coverage of what's happening in Iraq by what's left of the media in the U.S., so many people, even people who are opposed to the occupation of Iraq, really, it's almost this kind of cultish following that, well, Barack Obama says this, so I'm just going to go along with it. Let's look at what's actually happened on the ground there. Not one U.S. soldier has been withdrawn. There's been no reform happen that's going to bring any more benefit to the Iraqi people or bring reconstruction there. There's been no compensation paid to Iraqis for the suffering that U.S. policy has brought to them. There's basically been no visible change on the ground whatsoever. And I think the fact that people can't see this, they're not being shown this by most of the media, even much of the media on the left, again, I think it even makes accountability even more challenging. I mean, one benefit under the Bush administration is they were so bad and so blatant at what they did and had such callous disregard for what anyone thought of their policies that it was very easy for people to get riled up and point the finger and say, well, they need to do this, they need to do that, this policy needs to be changed. But now, with that out of the picture, and now that we have a Barack Obama administration that's less blatant, that's more articulate, that's more sophisticated, we still have a continuation of essentially the same policies abroad. But again, nobody's paying attention to it.
Dar, you pointed out in your reporting from Iraq, 4 provinces did not vote, and you mentioned the Kurdish-controlled north and the phenomenon that there was controversy over control of the oil-rich Kirkuk region.
Yes, it's another big story that's ongoing in Iraq that I think so many people here really haven't been told about, and that is, you know, we have these provincial elections that took place in Iraq at the very end of this past January, and they took place everywhere in Iraq except for the 4 northern, mostly Kurdish-controlled provinces. And they did not take place there because of the issue of Kirkuk, which is where the oil in northern Iraq lies. It's a city that the Kurds who want to go independent have to have control of, because that would basically be the main source of their economy, is the oil there. And it's such a contentious issue, because if they try to take that city, we already have Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, forming allegiances with different Sunni political groups, so that if the Kurds decide we're going to go independent and try to take Kirkuk with us, there will literally be an instantaneous civil war between the Arabs and the Kurds, the Arabs being both Sunni and Shia against the Kurds. There's been an ongoing effort by the Kurds to take control of Kirkuk, of literally doing ethnic cleansing, kicking Arabs and Turkmen out of that area, of trying to resettle it with more Kurds. And this is an ongoing, festering problem. And it's severe enough that they could not even have elections there, because, of course, it would beg the issue of control of Kirkuk to be addressed. And rather than this happening, they basically just postponed it yet again. So much for democracy. You can't even have elections there because the Kurds are so set on not using democratic means to try to take control of Kirkuk. And this, I think, is likely to be the next spark of a very large outbreak of violence in Iraq. I think the question is not if, but when is this going to occur?
And whether or not it will spread into other countries. I know the Israelis have been running a covert operation in Iran. The MEK is involved, the Mujahideen Khalq Group. Again, at the Iran border, that's where America has been working with these groups covertly. So it seems America would naturally be involved if Israel's doing a covert operation in Iran. And this, of course, if, as you say, this point of contention is not resolved and the oil is at stake, it's possible that various players will try to turn to Iran and to the Iranian leadership for support, and this will catalyze a wider war.
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything you said is true, and I would add that it already is a war that has spilled outside of Iraq's borders. I mean, every week now for months we've had Turkish warplanes using targets provided them by the U.S. military to bomb Kurdish rebel group sites in northern Iraq. We've had, on a monthly basis, at least every month at various times, we've had Iran using their artillery to hit Kurdish rebel groups' sites inside of Iraq, because these are Kurdish rebel groups, as you said, backed by the U.S. that are going into Iran to try to carry out assassinations and destabilization efforts. All of that coupled, of course, with both U.S. and Israeli support. So it's already a situation where we have events born of the U.S. occupation of Iraq that are spilling over into the borders of neighboring countries.
Dar, is there anything that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think that really we've covered all of it. I always like to impress upon people the need to keep paying close attention to how the situation is affecting the average person in Iraq, because this, more than ever before, has fallen completely off the radar of most media outlets. And the fact is, coming up on the six-year anniversary of the invasion, that Iraqis today are in worse shape than ever before. And there really doesn't appear to be any light at the end of the tunnel for them. And just the fact that it's not getting much media coverage at all anymore doesn't mean that it's not happening. So I really encourage people to keep paying very, very close attention to this, because the situation in Iraq is anything but resolved.
Dar Jamil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dori.
Dar Jamil also covered the Lebanon War, reporting on the millions of displaced Iraqis, too, living in camps in Iraq or whatever housing they can find as refugees in Jordan and other countries. He writes for Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and many other outlets. His webpage is darjamiliraq.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed. FritzHeed.com.